for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Fighting has intensified in both Basra and Baghdad and is now spreading to other cities in Iraq. Shiite militias are battling Iraqi security forces and U.S. firepower as the Iraqi parliament plans to meet in emergency session today. In Nepal, pro-Tibet protesters have jumped over the walls of the UN compound to demand UN intervention in Tibet. Joining me for the Friday News Roundup, Martin Walker of UPI, Kevin Whitelaw of U.S. News and World Report, and Hisham Malam of Al Arabiya Television. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Hisham Malam, Iraqi forces, Shiite militias battling for the fourth day in Basra. Where is this going?
This is the most lethal challenge in terms of security and political challenge to the Maliki government. This is the biggest challenge so far to the surge and to the whole infrastructure of security that was put together by General Petraeus. The fighting is likely to continue. I would even argue that it is likely to continue even on the 8th and the 9th of April, when General Petraeus, as well as Ryan Crocker, American ambassador in Baghdad, are testifying on the Hill, assuming that they will be here on time. It is likely also that if the fighting continues in Basra as well as in Baghdad, that Al-Qaeda, which made Mosul, the largest Iraqi city in the north, their stronghold now, also will open up a new front. So we are likely to witness a real major bloodletting that we haven't seen since 2004, 2005.
Martin.
And the oil price is probably going to go above $110 a barrel and stay there, because they hit the, during the fighting, one of the main export pipelines that delivers about 500,000 barrels a day was attacked. And an awful lot of this is about oil and who's going to control it and who's going to control the city of Basra and the port of Umkaza, out of which so much of the oil goes. But it's not just about that. It's also about, as Hisham said, it's a power struggle taking place within the Shiite community. And what you have is the Prime Minister Maliki is being backed by Abdulaziz Hakim, who's the head of the Badr Brigades, the head of the old traditional Skiri movement, which is very, very close indeed to Tehran. Whereas Muqtada al-Sadr, who runs the Mahdi army, or runs parts of it, it's very uncertain how much authority he's got, he has been much more of a kind of Iraqi nationalist, much more of a populist, appealing to the poor. It's going to be impossible for the Americans, or indeed any conceivable military operation, to root out his support in that Shiite community.
Kevin Whitelaw, what about this three-day ultimatum put down by the Iraqi prime minister, and then Maliki imposed a different deadline?
Well, you know, the first deadline was sort of a three-day, you know, hand over your weapons and give up kind of a deadline, and we're running right up against that. Another sort of broader deadline, 10-day, was announced to allow them allow citizens in general, and it appeared less targeted at militias, but to allow anybody to sort of hand over weapons and not not be penalized for having them. It's not clear really what that does at this point, because when the security situation is so clearly up in the air, when you've have reports of defections of policemen over to the militia, when you have some areas of the city that appear to be under police control and large areas that appear to be under militia control, it's not clear why anyone who has weapons would want to give them up.
Well, then you've got the Green Zone in Baghdad under shelling attack. Report on NPR this morning said you used to have a certain number a week. Now you're having a multiplication of numbers a day. What is the Iraqi parliament doing in its emergency session today?
Well, the Iraqi parliament is trying to save what's left of its reputation. Obviously, they failed miserably in meeting some of the benchmark that the United States had put a while ago. Although there is an agreement now to hold the provincial elections, but the main issue, which is a carbohydrate law,
hydrocarbon
hydrocarbon. I'm sorry, what am I talking? Hydrocarbon law to distribute the oil wealth. They have yet to achieve that, which is one of the biggest problems in Iraq, because, as Martin said, the oil here is at the heart of it, especially in the south, in the Shia area, where you have most of the oil. So I don't expect much from the Iraqi parliament, and I think what we are witnessing now is an intra-Shiite fight for the south in particular. Muqtada al-Sadr's biggest base is in the Sadr city in Baghdad.
What happened to his ceasefire?
I mean, you know, we've had ceasefires before. I mean, this is in any classic civil war, you have ceasefire after ceasefire. And Muqtada al-Sadr, the main reason for him accepting a ceasefire is because the American Marines in the last 3-4 years really have dealt the Jaish al-Mahdi, his militia, some serious blows. And there is defection, and this is a very loose movement. And yet he still has the allegiance of many of Baghdad's poor, even in the south too. And this is a man who articulates in his own fiery way their grievances, and they have, and these people, the poorest of the poor in Iraq, have yet to see an improvement in their economic lot. So I don't think necessarily he would like to take on the American Marines and the American forces head on, but we are likely to see that, because many people in the Maliki government would like to weaken him further to strengthen their position in the south.
Martin.
In November last year, the New York Times published a document, which apparently was drafted by Stephen Hadley, the National Security Advisor here, in which laid out the political strategy of the Bush administration, which was to isolate and eventually to crush Muqtada al-Sadr. And that is what we're now seeing on the ground. The difficulty about this, and I think it's quite clear the American government has been very much involved in the preparations and giving a green light for all of this. But the unintended consequences could be very, very severe, because the person who's really, I think, been deliberately unleashing an awful lot of this has been Abdulaziz Hakim, the head of Skiri, who has put an awful lot of his battle brigades into what are called the Iraqi security forces. He is determined to crush Muqtada al-Sadr. There's an old venom between the two of them. And what's more, what Hakim is and his Supreme Council are trying to do is to create a kind of a Shiite mini-state in the south, which will dominate the vast bulk of the oil wealth, and that will probably mean a breakup of Iraq.
Martin Walker of UPI, Kevin Whitelaw of U.S. News and World Report, Hisham Malam of Al Arabiya TV, and An-Nahar. You can join us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. At the same time, all of this violence is going on in Basra, in Baghdad, other cities of Iraq. Kevin, President Bush was very complimentary about Nouri al-Maliki, the Iraqi prime minister, for taking the initiative in fighting militias. Did the U.S. see all of this coming?
Well, you know, it's interesting. In the past few weeks, you know, U.S. officials, particularly in the Pentagon, have been quietly sort of downplaying how important this Sadr ceasefire has been to the overall drop in violence, and sort of surprised a lot of people, because this has obviously been very important. It's one of the most important factors, along with the Sunni awakening in Anbar province, that you know, even more so than the extra soldiers that were put into Baghdad. But they've started to downplay it in recent weeks, and so I think, you know, you could suggest that a lot of people saw this thing coming. The fact of the matter was, during the ceasefire, Sadr's militia was still being attacked by the U.S. forces and Iraqi forces at differing times, and there was only so long that he was going to be able to sort of put up with that before fighting back. And, you know, obviously the attacks we've seen are a reminder that he still has some potent support.
But apparently President Bush continues to believe that, number one, the surge is working, number two, normalcy is returning back to Iraq.
This is denial. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, looking at the contrast, the contrasting images of the green zone under fire, plumes of smoke covering the whole Iraqi capital, fighting raging in the south, the second largest city, where the Americans have really no serious American military presence. That part of the country, by the way, has been under the rule of various militias for a long time. Even the central law is not practiced there. Each militia practices its own Islamic version of law, whatever. And we have a mayhem on a wide scale in the south now. And the president is talking about the return of normalcy.
So how much power does Maliki's base of support have these days, Martin?
Well, he's certainly got about half of the Shia community, I would imagine. He's managed to reach a deal with the Kurds. He has not got any kind of support among the Sunni whatsoever. So he is pretty isolated. What's more, he hasn't even got command of his own capital city of Baghdad, where Sadr city is under very much the control of Muqtada al-Sadr's militia.
So, Kevin, the
but he has a majority in the parliament.
President Bush is meeting with military leaders this week. Will the current situation there in Iraq alter plans for future troop withdrawals?
Well, I think it's going to confirm what U.S. officials and President Bush have been leaning towards already, which was to have a halt in the drawdowns, and so that when the sort of final surge troops, if you like, are withdrawn by the end of the summer, you're still going to end up around probably 135,000 troops, 140,000 troops, which is indeed higher than the troop level before the surge started. So you're going to end up with a larger number of troops there, and that could well continue until the end of the year, really, depending upon what kind of situation we see. I mean, you know, there is always a chance that Sadr could decide to come to some sort of political accommodation. But obviously, with the violence we're seeing, this only confirms that they've got to hold
of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen, told NPR this morning, decisions will continue to be determined by conditions on the ground. He says he wants to reduce tours from 15 to 12 months. We shall see. Short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup, this week with Hisham Mellem of Al Arabiya TV, Kevin Whitelaw of U.S. News and World Report, Martin Walker of United Press International. Let's talk about this story that the New York Times had yesterday on the unsavory path of some arms being supplied to Afghanistan. What did the paper find, Kevin?
Well, this really was a very long, very interesting story where they were able to reconstruct the unusual path of this young 22, 23-year-old who managed to win himself a large contract to supply ammunition to Afghan security forces.
$300 million
contract. And without really any particular experience in doing this, and charts a really Byzantine path of working through Albanian middlemen and arms dealers and throughout Europe and Eastern Europe to be able to supply what often ended up being 30, 40, 50-year-old ammunition in pretty often degraded conditions to Afghan security forces. This, of course, was supposed to be one of the prime things we're doing is arming and training Afghan security forces so they can take the fight to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. This is supposed to be a centerpiece of what the U.S. is doing there.
His office is behind an unmarked door in Miami. What does this tell us about Pentagon oversight, Hisham?
This is an extremely embarrassing scandal for the Pentagon. This is a bad week for the Pentagon now that we've learned that the wrong nuclear shipments went to Taiwan, which is also another story. I think heads should roll. Not only the head of the 22-year-old kid and his one of his chief aides who's also a masseur. You know, this is what you have in Florida, I guess.
I don't understand.
There is so much stress in this business, so you need the massage once in a while.
But Martin, if this weren't so serious, it would be funny.
It's fiction. I read it. I read the New York Times account. It's like fiction.
It is like fiction. And the background to this is that there is something of a worldwide shortage of ammunition. And if you're going to try and re-equip the
Afghans, could have gone to the Middle East, Martin.
you need an awful lot of the stuff. And if you think about it, I mean, the average factory can turn out something like 150,000 rounds a day. It's going to take about a year to produce the 100 million rounds that were required. But the really bizarre thing is, while the Pentagon was going to the wonderful free market of private enterprise looking for cheap ammunition for the Afghans, they were destroying and blowing up by the ton, by the container
load.
That
kind of ammunition.
Exactly that kind of ammunition, exactly that kind of Soviet-style weaponry that they'd captured in Iraq. It's absolutely bizarre. It would have been easier for them to ship it out of Iraq into Afghanistan. Instead, they got this 60- or 50-year-old Chinese-made ammunition from Albania, which had been rotting steadily. And they then had to take it out of the Chinese boxes, which were at least hermetically sealed, because they didn't want to show how old the ammunition was, and they put it into cardboard boxes. By the time you got to the Afghans, the cardboard boxes were falling apart. Mm. There were rounds going everywhere. There were loose RPG rounds rolling around inside the trucks, and the Afghans just think...
You know, this raises questions about procurement and contracting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know what's happening to the Pentagon now. Everything, some of these missions or skills missions that the Army or the Pentagon would do, now they are going outside the military and contracting, you know, with companies, apparently without the real kind of vetting that you would expect.
And what about the Chinese government's concern over this mistaken shipment of fuses for nuclear missiles from the U.S. to Taiwan?
Well, the most interesting thing about this story is how long it took to figure this out. In 2006, in the fall, the United States shipped helicopter, what they thought were batteries for helicopters, out to Taiwan. Turned out they mistakenly sent these fuses that were meant for intercontinental ballistic missiles, which are obviously part of a nuclear program.
To Taiwan,
are controlled technologies and are obviously potentially be seen as quite provocative to China. It took them until basically, I believe it was last week, to actually discover that
after Taiwan informed them,
actually sent the wrong thing. Well, they knew they'd sent something, the wrong parts, but they hadn't realized which wrong parts they'd sent. So it suggests there's, at the very least, an inventory control issue. And you did indeed watch Defense Secretary Robert Gates order a full inventory of all of the Pentagon's nuclear nuclear supplies and related supplies.
Let me ask you all, we talk each week about Iraq, but what is happening in Afghanistan, Isha?
In Afghanistan, you have the Taliban are on the ascendancy. They've been regrouping in large parts of the country, in part because NATO is reluctant to increase its forces, and because we don't have enough American forces to send to Afghanistan, and because nation building did not really proceed. You have a government that is barely in control of Kabul. There is nominal control, if you will, over the rest of the country, but that's it. And the area close to Afghan-Pakistan border is not also under the control of the government. And then on the other side, on the Pakistani side, you have Waziristan, which is Dodge City, if you will. And the central government in Kabul is very weak. And I think we have a deteriorating situation in terms of security, in terms of the politics of Afghanistan and the economy. I mean, opium production is now the most important source of income for many Afghans.
Are we still looking for Osama bin Laden?
Well, I'm sure we are, but the difficulty is there's now a new government in Pakistan which is going to be giving even less support to the Americans in the war on terror than Musharraf did. And Musharraf was very much a fair-weather friend, depending upon the politics of the day. Indeed, the one of the leaders of the new elected coalition that's got the majority in the Pakistani parliament, Nawaz Sharif, has made it very clear that there should be no more U.S. airstrikes inside Pakistan, that there should be an end to Pakistan support for the war on terrorism. And this is going to be, I think, the pattern for the remainder of this year, as this new power struggle between Nawaz Sharif and the new Prime Minister Yusuf Galani and the Benazir Bhutto's widower Asif Zardari work out their own little power play.
You know, it was interesting because Deputy Secretary of State John Negroponte was in Pakistan this week. He did not exactly receive a warm welcome, Ken.
No, a lot of Pakistanis weren't happy to see him. The U.S. really has been perceived as supporting Musharraf rather than supporting the Pakistani people or the Pakistani political process. And since U.S. policy has become so closely identified with a man who's becoming so unpopular, that visit was seen as a perhaps an arm twisting of the new government that was not welcome.
He was asked an embarrassing question. He was asked, "How is Pakistan different from Honduras?" What's behind that question?
Well, you know, a lot of this gets to that larger question of the U.S. talking, you know, it's a number of different questions. I mean, you know, part of it is the democracy question and
it's to do with his
and his
background.
His role in Honduras
in the dirty war, sure. And the secret war.
He was accused of collaborating with the death squads and all that.
That's right.
Well, but what can you tell us about the reports that the U.S. has stepped up unilateral attacks against suspected al-Qaeda members in Pakistan?
Well, I think this is entirely true, and it's because it's been sort of trailed, it's been hinted at by various U.S. officials that if they're not going to get the kind of support they need from the Pakistanis, they're going to have to take their own actions. And because of the drones, because of the unmanned aircraft that can fire missiles, they have the capacity to do that. There are now suggestions inside the Pakistani media that in fact that there are American special forces operating inside Pakistan.
I think in this case there was also a sense that the U.S. has maybe stepped it up right now because they fear that they're going to, you know, have their ability to do this curtailed very shortly in the future. So it was sort of, while we still have a bit of freedom to operate with Musharraf's blessing, let's get in there, let's do a few extra
things. How much power does Musharraf have right now?
It's diminishing each passing day, obviously, and the recent elections is a major testimony to that. And I agree, the reason for this escalation in the American activity using the drones in the area of Waziristan is precisely because they expect that the new government, the new political structure there, which is going to weaken Musharraf, is going to ask the Americans to not to be very visible in this war, and they're saying essentially, Waziristan is our problem, although they would look the other way if the Americans are attacking the so-called Afghan Arabs.
But, you know, it's interesting that the new prime minister released the judges that had been detained by Musharraf when he imposed emergency rule.
Well, yes, indeed. And it's this is the new prime minister, a man called Yusuf Galani, who is a very, very smart choice by Benazir Bhutto's widower, because he's from the Punjab. And the Punjab is the political base of Nawaz Sharif. Traditionally, the Bhutto's base is in Sindh. And so he's reaching out there to the Punjabis.
He said he would
Galani.
Also ask the UN to investigate the assassination of Benazir.
He did indeed. But what was important, what was most important for Pakistanis was having freed, announced that the judges would be freed, he did not then give a firm date for them to be reinstated. Because he knows perfectly well that the moment those judges are reinstated, they will declare Musharraf's election as president to be null and void. And the whole point about what Zardari is doing is to position himself in the middle between Musharraf on the one side, Nawaz Sharif on the other. And I think he's playing a very subtle political game. However, there is another timetable taking place here. One reason reason why the Americans have stepped up their attacks inside northern Pakistan is because of next week's NATO summit. Everybody's waiting for the Taliban spring offensive to take place. Nobody wants NATO summit to be interrupted by new bombs, mayhem, military action taking place in Afghanistan just at the time when some of the European leaders are bracing themselves for the internal uproar that will be caused if they give more support, any more troops to the Afghan mission.
I just wanted to say that the judges have become the symbol of resistance, legal resistance, legitimate resistance to the Musharraf government, and that's why their release, even if no date has been signed, is extremely important symbolically and politically for the new regime in Pakistan.
At the same time, I think Zardari, Bhutto's widow, has to be a little careful because, you know, he could find himself in a certain amount of legal jeopardy if some of these judges get reinstated as well. So there are some interesting balancing acts that they have to play on that because there's some corruption investigations that some of these judges have suggested they would reopen if they had been in power.
So. He's seen by many, many, many Pakistanis as probably the most corrupt politician or man in public life in Pakistan.
Known as Mr. 10%.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's talk about what's happening in Tibet and the message that the Chinese government is trying to get out to the world, Hisham.
We may be seeing something similar to Tiananmen. So Bush 43 will probably face a similar problem to the one that Bush 41 faced with the Chinese. I don't expect the Chinese government to back down. I think they still believe that a crackdown could still save the Olympics and save the Communist Party and its what's left of its reputation. I think they're going to have a big problem. I don't expect the Tibet crisis to... It will continue to simmer down for a long time, and I think the fact that everybody will be focused on the Olympics, the people of the Tibet and their supporters around the world are going to continue the pressure on the Chinese government, and I think at least there will be some form of boycott. They may boycott the opening ceremony. There will be some symbolic boycotts. I don't expect something similar to what happened to Moscow after the invasion of Afghanistan when Jimmy Carter boycotted the Olympics in Moscow. Although I wonder why democracies in the world will not use the Olympics to put real pressure on China.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. At the same time, hasn't France said it may boycott at least the opening, if not the entire Olympics?
We've seen some indications of a number of different countries trying to figure out how to calibrate this message. And you watch President Bush here yesterday try to thread this needle as well, criticizing the Chinese for the crackdown, but making it relatively clear that he's not going to try to use any boycott, that he will indeed be there. Sort of interesting choice to sort of take off the table the sort of one potent weapon he might have had on that. So in the meantime, you have the Chinese mounting their own public relations campaign by bringing foreign journalists and now foreign diplomats into Tibet to try to show them, look, everything's fine over there.
But look what happened yesterday on camera.
Oh, it really backfired. They went into one of the main monasteries and where the pro-Chinese administrator was saying, look, all is now calm, it's getting better. And the monks came in and said, we are not free. We want Tibet to be free. We also support and we believe in the Dalai Lama. And then the further parts of this Potemkin village kind of tour that the Chinese laid on for the reporters, they talked to a young Tibetan nurse who was standing by a wrecked ambulance, and they asked her if she was religious. She said, yes, my religion is Marxism. So the kind of people that they were seeing were very, very carefully vetted, but it all went wrong because of the monks, and I think that the impact of this is going to get stronger and stronger. In Britain, for example, the Prime Minister Gordon Brown has pretty much been forced to say he will now be seeing the Dalai Lama when he next comes to Britain.
Does the Dalai Lama really want independence?
He says not. He's been saying it repeatedly, but the Chinese insist that he does. When Hu Jintao, the Chinese leader, spoke to President Bush this week by telephone and Bush was calling for a restraint, apparently Hu Jintao said, well, I might be prepared to meet the Dalai Lama if he renounces the cause of Tibetan independence. He's done so for over 10 years. The Chinese are bombarding their own people with lies in propaganda about the Dalai Lama.
What about these Tibet students who reached the UN compound in Kathmandu, Nepal. they're asking the UN to walk into this. That's
what I meant. I mean, this is not going to go away as far as the Chinese government is concerned. And there will be acts of defiance, demonstrations. Now it's in Nepal. It will go to other places. And there will be international pressure on the Chinese. And I think European attitudes may change. I'm not sure about the Bush administration's attitude in the end. But there will be pressure on the Chinese the closer we get to the Olympics. I mean, this is the time for those people who are seeking greater and greater freedom for the people of the Tibet to use the pressure.
I agree that it's probably the time, you know, it's the strategic moment. They've got a small window where they know the world's attention is going to be on China, and that China will feel on some level a bit restrained in its response, because they don't want to create some enormous problem.
They made all kinds of promises before they got the Olympics. Those promises have simply not been kept.
Well, you know, at the same time, to be perfectly fair in this situation, there was looting. There were attacks by some of the demonstrators as well. So there, you know, the Chinese have been trying to talk about this as a law and order issue. Clearly, it's much more than that. But there is still that question. You're going to see a very, very tight, suffocating Chinese security presence in Tibet and the surrounding provinces. They are going to take this extremely seriously and try to prevent any future outbreaks.
Kevin Whitelaw of U.S. News and World Report, Martin Walker of UPI, Isham Mellem, Washington correspondent for An-Nahar, and bureau chief for Al Arabiya TV. Short break. When we come back, your calls.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by this and other NPR stations, and by American University, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org, and by UVA's Miller Center, presenting a national debate, Should Religion and Politics Mix? Video, transcript, and broadcast details at millercenter.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
There's a new two-disc collector's edition of the 1967 film classic Bonnie and Clyde. On the next Fresh Air, an interview with the director, Arthur Penn. He'll describe how he choreographed the famous climax in which Bonnie and Clyde are gunned down. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And crossing the AP wire this morning at 11:33, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says China has not lived up to its commitments to improve human rights conditions, but that it would be a mistake to boycott the Beijing Olympics. She says, I believe a boycott would unfairly harm our athletes who've worked so hard to prepare for the competition. At the same time comes an email from Chip in Cary, North Carolina, who says, I'm wondering if the U.S. is being relatively mute in criticism of China's crackdown on Tibetans because of China's investment in our national debt. Martin Walker.
Well, it's very hard to be rude to your banker. China is sitting upon $1,500 billion of foreign exchange. The vast bulk of it is US dollars, treasury securities, and so on. And it's no doubt that in the current state of the US financial markets and of Wall Street, people do not want to be provocative to the Chinese, whatever they do. The question is, just how much worse does China have to be before people do start standing up and saying, we can't take part in an Olympics with this bunch?
All right, let's go now to Statesville, North Carolina. Good morning, Philip.
Good morning, Diane, and let me tell you how much I enjoy your program
every day. Thank you so much.
This is early in your show. You were talking about the Pentagon's latest procurement problems, and I just had to say that it's another example of the thing that probably scares me more than losing the right of habeas corpus or freedom of speech or any of the other freedoms that Bush appears to be attacking, is the level of incompetence in this administration. I don't think there's any comparison with another administration. The Harding administration were crooks. The earlier administrations in my life had various levels of incompetence or dishonesty, but this one absolutely takes the cake. And the incompetence is more scary than anything.
Thanks for calling, Philip. Kevin.
Well, you know, I was just going to add that one of the interesting things about this story is that, you know, so often when it comes to these contracting issues, the scandals tend to surround, you know, political cronies or friends or sweetheart deals or whatever else. This doesn't appear to be any of that. This appears to be the simple incompetence of going to the lowest bidder without doing due diligence about what is actually behind there. And I think there is a larger story here about the fact that the Pentagon has lost a lot of its contracting expertise over the years, that they've contracted out the contracting process to the point where they don't have the people who are skilled at doing this kind of work at a time where we are more reliant on it than ever.
All right, to Michelle in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Good morning.
Yes, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask, I'm thinking that Afghanistan, in terms of it being Afghan-Contra, it's drugs, money, weaponry. And I also wondered if your guest could connect the dots with Admiral Fallon's departure, then a couple days later, the third ship heads to that region, the third carrier. Yesterday, I believe it was, you heard sort of the Bush megaphone voice saying about the Iranian and Syrian involvement in the region. Then we seem to have stepped back in Iraq and are letting this sort of in-house fighting take place now. So I'm wondering, is that the October surprise? Are we still heading in that direction, still beating the drums for Iran?
Well, the caller raised too many issues. I think Admiral Fallon fell because of his opposition to the not only an attack on Iran, but also his questions and his reservations about the surge, about maintaining a large American military force in Iraq. He believes, like other senior officers apparently do believe, that this is a real drain on the army, on the future of the armed forces, and the capability of the United States to deal with other serious crises. And he's been critical. I mean, I have a long list of quotes about his positions and reservations about the war in Iraq. And also, the piece in Esquire made it very clear that he's not very comfortable with the vice president's in particular and the president's views on Iran and what to do with Iran. Now, whether this administration is going to attack Iran is a big question. I can tell you that one of the reasons why Vice President Cheney went to the Middle East was to try to explain to the allies, particularly the Saudis and the others, the whole confusion that emanated from the NIE controversy, you know, where you have a document saying essentially the Iranians stopped their military nuclear program, and then the President of the United States essentially contradicting that publicly. I mean, if we didn't understand it here in Washington, you can imagine the confusion in the region.
Well, you know, and on that intelligence question, we have seen that many times. You know, we saw that in parts of, you know, throughout Iraq, where the administration would often differ from what the intelligence folks were saying.
But
we're seeing that again on Iran now, quite substantially.
She is asking, shall we expect an October surprise in regard to Iran?
I wouldn't rule it out. There's no doubt that very powerful voices inside the Bush administration, led, I think, by the vice president, firmly believe that perhaps there should be...
Still
believe that the one thing is worse than Iran having a nuclear weapon. One thing is worse than bombing Iran, and that would be for Iran to have a nuclear weapon, which is the formulation that Senator McCain has put upon it. I've always been dubious about this because from talking to the U.S. Air Force people, the view seems to be that in order to be able to hit the targets, even if you knew where all of them were, you'd probably need 3 nights of suppression bombing to take to destroy the anti-aircraft defenses of the Iranians. And in those 3 days, I would imagine Bush would probably be impeached if he were to launch this kind of attack in October. There would be absolute uproar in Congress. There'd probably be uproar on the streets
One
of the
month
country.
Before the election, you would see impeachment, Martin?
Well, what else is the Congress going to do if Bush decides, regardless of Congress, to go ahead and start bombing Iran?
Martin, look, I mean, since the surge, I mean, in the last 18 months, since the Democrats took over both houses, both chambers, they've done nothing to stop them in Iraq.
Well, that's because they haven't been able to sort of get a sufficient majority. But,
exactly.
I mean, I think there'd be an outcry if there were to be this kind of attack in October.
All right.
But one further point on Fallon. It wasn't just that he was he was against the idea of Iran. He was also against the idea that the Bush administration was looking at the world through Iraq-shaped blinkers and wasn't focusing enough upon other places like Afghanistan or like his previous mission, which was China. And I think that he was absolutely right.
And he complained
right
about those
that.
Publicly.
And the final point, and this goes to Kevin's argument about the incompetence of this administration, is that at the very time when they have been whipping up the drums of war around Iran and threats and so on. At the same time, they are now in bed with the factions inside Iraq, which are most subservient to the Iranians.
All right, let's go to San Antonio, Texas. Michael, you're on the air.
Hello. Actually, on that same point that the panelist was just saying, I was surprised to learn from Frontline the other night that we had been paying the Sadr faction, the Sadr army. And I don't think most of Americans are aware of how fractionist the situation is and that we're actually paying warlords off. So that's my point.
To have them protect and disarm.
That's right. Well, this is one of the ways in which a certain amount of peace has been bought in Iraq over the last few months, is large amounts of U.S. dollars have been flooding to various people.
But we've been talking about that on this program for months.
That's
it
right.
has been.
It's not simply that they are opposed to the Al-Qaeda in their midst that got the Sunni sheikhs to decide that they would join the awakening. It was very, very large sums of money.
Yeah, and the money is probably one of the more important factors along here. And I think what it speaks to is the fragility of particularly the Sunni awakening. We're relying much more so on the Sunni side than on the Shiite side, relying on these payments to try to win the support and win the backing and win and have extra security neighborhood watch. We've seen some of these forces defect. We've seen that their loyalties remain extremely, extremely tenuous.
I mean, we should stress that the money is going to mostly the Shia, to the Sunni tribesmen in the center and not to the Sadr.
And on that very point, Julian in Raleigh, North Carolina, you have a question for the panel.
Thank you, Diane. My wife and I enjoy your very informative and interesting show every day.
Thank you
for all that. I was just wondering if somebody could explain the difference between the Shiites and the Sunnis. Is it like in Northern Ireland when they had the Catholics and the Protestants, or is it like in this country the Baptists and the Methodists might be against each other? We're not very clear about why the difference between the Shiites and the Sunnis.
I understand your confusion, Julian.
If you can give me an hour, I can do that. Look, these are initially political differences that evolved later on into almost what we say in the West, theological differences. Essentially, it began over the disagreement over who was going to the succession. From the beginning of Islam, there was always a problem of succession. And we had the fitna wars with the sedition wars initially. And then the Shia believed that the fourth caliph, Ali bin Abi Talib, should have been the rightful successor because he was very close to Muhammad. Exactly, but he was the fourth Khalifa, and he was assassinated. Then his son Hussein became the symbol of martyrdom when he was assassinated, along with 70 of his followers in Karbala, in what is today Iraq, at the hands of the Umayyad Caliph in Damascus. And that's why this is Ashura. This is the most sacred day in the Shia calendar, and this is the day that every year the Shia all over the world commemorate. And sometimes they try to even inflict emotional, physical pain on themselves to go through an experience similar to what Hussein and his followers went through. So initially it was political. Later on it developed. For instance, Shia believe that the rightful succession should be in the house, in Ahl al-Bayt, which is the household of the Prophet. And then all of the, most Shia believe, we call them 12er Shias, because they believe in the 12 Imams who were descended from Hussein. And the last one, when he was 5 years old, he disappeared. And they are waiting for the imam to return. It's almost like the Messiah waiting for this would be the end of the world. And these 12 Shia imams are almost revered like saints in Christianity. These are some of the differences. I mean, the Sunnis look down at this kind of practice, at this outlook on life. And so the differences began as political differences and then evolved into more theological later on.
With the exception of Iran, which is largely Shia.
Iraq too.
And southern Iraq, equally in southern Iraq, mm-hmm. What you've seen is that the Sunni see themselves as superior, and there's become a class dimension to this division as well as the theological one.
Absolutely.
All right, Dan, to Cincinnati, Ohio. By the way, thank you both for that explanation. It helps me a lot as well. Harry, you're on the air.
Yes, Diane. Look, this Bush, you said made some remark about this war being romantic. You're romanticizing the war. And, you know, it's not being romantic, being shot at and shelled and seeing your friends killed and maimed. That's all I have to say.
I appreciate your call. And, of course, that is a reminder to all of us that war, in whatever form, is hell. At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Irene in Sanford, North Carolina. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Your previous lady caller, I think she's absolutely on the mark. There will be an October surprise attacking Iran. There's a way to rally the Republicans and the rest of the country and elect John McCain.
Are you...
I think there's two mitigating factors. I mean, we've talked about some of the reasons why this indeed could, you know, why people fear this could happen. I think there's two very important mitigating factors. One is every war game the Pentagon has ever done on an attack on Iran ends badly for the United States. They've never been able to war game this in a way that it actually comes out well. So when you get into it, most military people look at this and say, this is not there's no way to win this. The second part is simply the strain on the U.S. forces. We have so many engaged in Iraq. We're watching the violence take up there.
Don't forget the Iranian retaliation. And it's going to be ugly, not only
indeed.
In Iraq.
And the strain on the economy. Oil will go to $200 a barrel.
Absolutely.
All right. To a caller here in Washington, D.C., Raed, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I am actually half Sunni and half Shiite. And I think that the recent events in Basra are a great example of how this Western narrative of Sunnis and Shiites fighting for ages is wrong. What's happening in Iraq is a political and economic war between Sunnis and Shiites who are nationalists against other Sunnis and Shiites who are separatists and who want to secede. I wish we can hear more from the Iraqi narrative instead of just repeating over and over one narrative and debating its details.
Well, I think we did try to make the point that there is a class distinction taking place in this that's part of this Sunni Shia divide. And earlier on in the program, we talked about the indeed I remember referring to it. We talked about the way in which there seems to be a separatist movement among the Shia, particularly surrounding the traditional Skiri forces, and that Muqtada al-Sadr is seen by many people inside Iraq as an Iraqi nationalist who is not in the pockets of Iran, and that it clearly is one of the really important dynamics that's taking place within the Iraqi politics.
People always fight for economic purposes, for political power, but they always couch it with religious or ideological garbs.
Absolutely.
And that's what's happening in Iraq.
And quickly, Hisham, here's an email for you. Would Mr. Malam comment on the apparent boycott of the Arab League summit in Damascus by Egypt and Saudi Arabia?
Absolutely. The Damascus summit is going to be boycotted essentially by the Saudis, who are sending a very low level participation, their ambassador to the Arab League. The Egyptians also were supposed to send their foreign minister. Now they're sending a lower-ranking official.
Why?
The Lebanese boycotted the summit completely, partly because of the negative Syrian role in Lebanon. The Syrians are essentially seen by most Arabs, as well as the Europeans and the Americans, as preventing the Lebanese from electing a president for a few months now. And they don't want them to be rewarded by giving them the kind of the garb of legitimacy, if you will, when the Arabs go in Damascus. That's why the boycott.
Hisham Malam, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya TV. Kevin Whitelaw, Senior Writer for U.S. News and World Report. Martin Walker of UPI. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinker, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Emmanuel Tui. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.